Hi, I'm Sally Hughes and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? What are their go-to products? Are they obsessive about their appearance or is it low on their list of priorities? And how have time and experience changed the way they feel about the way they look? Today's guest is my friend Jojo Moyes. I'm so excited. Jojo is a writer whose career encompasses not just 16 books, but a decade working for The Independent and a stint writing brochures for Club 18 to 30. Obviously not in that order. After her first three novels were rejected by publishers, her fourth, the last she was prepared to attempt before giving up, triggered a bidding war. Since then, Jojo's books have been translated into 46 languages and sold well over 40 million copies worldwide. 2012's Me Before You sold 14 million copies alone and was adapted by Moyes into a 2016 film. Jojo, whose fans include Oprah and the Obamas, has said, "If I wasn't a writer, I would have loved to have been a psychotherapist. I'm so fascinated by how brains work and how we get stuck in the patterns we get stuck in and why we self-sabotage." So how much does that idea of self-sabotage apply to Jojo herself? Is she able to hide behind her work, or has her incredible success made her much more visible than she ever bargained for? Jojo's also said, "Grumpy, complex, harried, compassionate, capable women doing stuff. That's all I want." Well, she's come to the right place.
But before that, a massive thank you to our wonderful series sponsor, Skin & Me. Skin & Me is your most accessible, fast track to simplified skincare, offering powerful active ingredients in formulations you can't buy on the high street. Skin & Me can create a treatment for your specific skin concerns, tailored to you by experts. Whether you want to target adult acne, pigmentation, melasma, rosacea, or skin aging, this is powerful, personalized skincare that truly works. As someone who has used Skin & Me for years, I can honestly say I wouldn't go without it. Later in this series, I'm delighted to say we'll be joined by one of Skin & Me's very own dermatologists to answer any and all of your pressing skincare questions. Now, on to today's episode of Beyond the Bathroom.
Welcome, Jojo Moyes.
Hi, Sally.
Hello. I'm so glad you're here. I've wanted you on for ages. We were going to get you on series one, and then what reminded me to get you on to series two was a comment that you made recently on Facebook about growing up and how you felt. So before we get to that, tell me a little bit about your mother or your father, whoever it was that kind of brought the realm of appearances into your world.
Do you know, I was thinking about this while I was walking the dogs this morning. I think my family was spectacularly unfocused on appearances.
So is mine.
And I think a lot of it has fed into my life and my work. And my mother, I think her skincare routine, not that I ever saw it take place, was a pot of Nivea. That was it. And she was lucky enough to have kind of good bone structure, and she actually looked much younger than her age until she died. I don't remember her getting regular haircuts. I think her husband cut her hair for the last 20, 30 years of her life. She just had a sort of straight bob. So everything I've learned about skincare has really been through my own trial and error and realizing that I had to look after myself. I didn't have the great skin that my mother had. So a lot of it was about just me testing what worked for me.
And what's your sibling setup? What's the shape of your family?
It's a little bit modern. I have three half brothers and sisters. My mother remarried when I was 19 and had my brother Guy. So he's 20 years younger than me. And then my dad had already remarried, I think maybe I was about 17, and had two daughters, Bea and Clem, who are, again, roughly 20 years younger than me. All my half siblings came at the same time, but we didn't grow up together because I'd already left home. And then I have a couple of step siblings from my mother's husband's first marriage who are much older than me. So it's
like a messy elastic
affair. It's a very elastic messy thing and kind of functional in its dysfunctionality. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that has fascinated me in my writing career, which is, you know, families are not nuclear. They're full of kind of weird complications and knots. And that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah. And some of them are chosen and unchosen and all of that
exactly.
stuff. Can you remember the first time you were aware then of your appearance? If it wasn't a focus in your household, can you remember the first time you thought, okay, this is me, this is how I look, for better or worse?
I can tell you the first time I was aware of something, maybe my attractiveness, and I wasn't a particularly attractive child. I think I came to be comfortable in my own skin at a much later age than most people. But I remember being on a bus in Hackney and a guy putting his hand on my leg when I was about 13.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking, I mean, such a mixture of things. One was horror because I didn't know what to do. But another one
How
was...
How old was this guy?
Oh, God, I can't remember. Probably middle-aged or, you know, definitely way
a
older
man.
Than he should have
yeah.
been. But I also remember suddenly realising that there was power in femininity, that what I did could impact men. And that was quite shocking to me because I think I didn't grow up with any siblings. So I had no sense of anybody to emulate or what I looked like. We weren't a household that was overly fussed by mirrors. You know, it was all about what you saw in the world. Both my parents were involved in the arts. So it was much more about looking outwards than looking inwards. And both my parents had a very strong Protestant work ethic. So everybody was always working. I suppose there was a bit of that thing of it's a bit self-indulgent to pay too much attention to yourself. And my mum grew up Catholic, which I think brings with it its own sense of guilt and, you know, not paying too much attention to yourself. So I probably absorbed some of that.
And what did you think about that? What did you think of that day on the bus where you thought, oh, this sort of does things to people, albeit dreadful people doing dreadful things, but this does something to people, the way I look. Did you then go back to school a slightly different person?
Not for a while, because I think, as I said, I wasn't a conventionally attractive child. I was always very small. So, you know, I was slight and small and boyish. I often had kind of tomboy haircut. So I remember weeping once because my mum had given me my neighbour's son's old parka jacket. And I became convinced that everyone would assume I was a boy because only boys wore parka jackets and I had short hair. And sure enough, most people did. I just wasn't feminine looking. And in fact, that only really hit, I think, when I went to university and I grew my hair instead of having tomboy hair, and suddenly I became a focus. And it wasn't always the right kind of attention. I went through a huge stage, sort of 15 years, I would say, from my late teens to late 20s, maybe less than 15 years. Maths was never my strong point. Where
you're a writer, obviously it wasn't. No. There were no writers who were good at maths. That's not a thing.
But I attracted a lot of the wrong sort of attention all
How do
the time.
You mean?
So I mean, I was telling my daughter recently, I had a whole realm of stalkers at one point. Yeah, I think there's something about how I look or looked back then to do with slightness. And I didn't give off the energy of someone who was very confident in holding space. So I had a lot of incursions into my space. I grew up in Hackney at a time when Hackney was not fun. And if you're a small blonde girl at that point walking around Hackney, I mean, I got chased with knives. I got, you know, I had got mugged. I got used to walking home from the bus I got to school with my keys through my fingers at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, because I knew when men were going to follow me. I could feel it. You know, you talked in one of your podcasts about being hypervigilant. That's exactly how I grew up. I can sense the trouble in a half mile radius.
Same.
I know where it's coming from.
Same.
And we got broken into a lot as well. We, you know, our house and our neighbour's house were quite frequently getting burgled. And so I didn't grow up with a sense of safety. And add to that this, you know, probably quite fragile appearance. Men kind of assumed stuff about me.
This is a very interesting topic to me. So obviously, you can only hear us at the moment. You can't see us. So Jojo basically looks like me. Like, because we always say, don't we? Oh, what have you got on, Jojo? What
we're
have you
very
got on?
Similar body shapes.
Every time we see each other, we want to know what each other's wearing because we're both little people. Being a little person is quite complicated because on the one hand, you know, Madonna famously said, small people try harder, which I was always really inspired by when I was little. But also being little makes lots of people feel like bigger people easily.
Yes.
To have control to be attracted to a small woman makes lots of bad men feel big, right? Yeah. Has that been your experience?
Oh, God, yes. And also, I think I didn't, you know, I grew up in the 80s. I came of age in the 80s when we didn't have the same vocabulary around relationships that we have now.
No.
And it was very interesting. You picked up on this comment that I made that we were going to talk about later. But I think so much of my life, and that's to do with my own personal appearance, has been about strength.
Uh-huh.
Because I think if you grow up feeling like you don't have much, then
you want to find it.
Yeah. And so for me, attractiveness comes with strength. It's not about being passive or ultra feminine. I'm not interested in that. I was never interested in being that. I never wanted to get married. I mean, I did end up getting married because to me, that whole bridal thing,
oh my God,
carries a layer of passivity that I didn't feel. And that's not to offend everybody who ever got married. It's just that was the image I had in my head of a woman being given from one man to another. And that just didn't feel like something that I wanted.
It's an actual psychological theory that, because my therapist said it to me one day. He said, you hate feeling like a bride. And I hate feeling like a bride. You know, it's that very specific feeling, isn't it, that happens in everyday life.
Yeah.
Those moments where you feel like a bride and it makes me panic. I hate it.
Yeah. And I think also being hyper visible in this very multicultural area that I grew up in made me feel vulnerable. And it's interesting that the things I struggle with now are also to do with being too visible. Like, I love being on a podcast or a radio show. It's not that I'm uncomfortable with my appearance. I just don't necessarily want people to look at me.
Yes. No, it's a different thing, isn't it? You could look like anything, but your impulse would still be, please don't.
Yes.
So when did that penny drop for you? You say, you know, there was a marked change where you thought, actually, for me, this is about strength and about feeling more powerful.
I think it was a few things. I mean, I was a slightly odd child because I grew up obsessed by horses, despite living in Hackney. And when I was 14, I saved up money from a cleaning job. As you say, short people try harder. Mm-hmm. I worked from a very early age. You and I have often spoken about the fact that we were grafters from very young. And I bought a horse and I felt safe on a horse. I could go anywhere on a horse because nobody would touch me. So this, you know, slight blonde kid suddenly became free. And I remember that sense of freedom very clearly. But horses come with a lot of work. You have to do an awful lot of physical work. And you also have to show up every single day to look after them. And so I became very wiry. I became very strong. And I walked everywhere in London because my parents would give me money for my lunch and my travel. And I would use that to pay for the horse. Mm-hmm. It was like £7.50 a week and my stables cost £15 a week. So I would do that and then my cleaning job. And so I became quite strong and fit from a very early age. And it was just a matter of necessity. It wasn't that I was focusing on my appearance. It was just the byproduct. But I'm really glad of that time now because, you know, if you believe in muscle memory, I think the reason I've always found it relatively easy to stay fit and strong is because I was doing it from such
an
early age.
I've
been highly active, all the time.
Let's pause this conversation briefly to thank our brilliant series sponsor, Skin and Me. Everyone deserves to feel good in their own skin, and Skin and Me are here to make that happen without the fuss of a complicated routine. Filled with active ingredients, Skin and Me products streamline your routine and maximize your results. A skincare routine is also a great way to ensure you take time for yourself every day. No matter how busy my days get,
I wind down and enjoy my Skin and Me moment. Their highly effective formulations won't be found on the high street and use active ingredients that work to repair, rebuild, and reinforce your skin barrier on a cellular level. If you've been struggling with your skin recently, I'd really recommend you try Skin and Me. Simple, effective, great value skincare that's designed for your skin. And that's one less thing to think about. Try your first month of personalised treatment from Skin and Me for $4.99 instead of the usual $24.99. Just visit skinandme.com and use the code SALLYANDME to get started. That's SALLYANDME to get started.
Your first profession was as your first proper profession was as a journalist. Also, as a journalist myself, I wondered, I think where you do your journalism it is really, really different as a woman. So working on magazines is a really different experience for a woman.
Very much.
From working on a paper. I came up through magazines, then moved into newspapers. And people are always really, really, really quick to criticise women's magazines. But actually, mums at women's magazines get to go home and be with their kids. There's not... It's a different type of toxicity, of workplace toxicity. And actually, I felt kind of supported as a woman. In newspapers, as a newspaper journalist, I would say that it's almost a hindrance to look put together and to look nice because people take you less seriously.
Definitely.
My entire career in newspapers has been a series of people being quite surprised that I can string a sentence together because of the way I look, because I'm wearing lipstick and nice shoes or whatever.
And it was very masculine, the world, especially when I was promoted to news desk level. I would say the women who were my mentors there did not wear makeup.
Right.
And probably looking at them now, you would say they were quite masculine. But you kind of had to.
Yeah.
You had to be tough. And I could never go back to that world now because I've lost all my hard edges. It did require, because you were having to ring people up all the time who didn't necessarily want to be spoken to. It was very different from the email text culture that we have now. You had to go and push your way into situations. You know, I was in Belfast covering the Troubles, you know, in riots, or I was in Hong Kong. You know, it was so not about your appearance. It was about whether you could do the job, get into the place and show up. And get the thing written by deadline time. So I think I didn't give my appearance much thought beyond what I did. I've always over-identified with my work as well. So I probably...
So I found a quote from you, which I can completely relate to.
Right.
I think lots of women can. I absolutely mourned my identity as a journalist when I gave it up. I had to go into therapy then too, because I didn't know who I was beyond my work. That's been a problem for me my whole life. I over-identify with what I do, and that's pretty shaky ground to rest on. I mean, I read that last night and thought, oof, that is totally who I am and how lots of women are. Because actually, one of the things about growing up with mums who were second wave feminists, as mine was, first to second wave, is that I absolutely thought that I wrapped my entire self-worth in what I did for money. So tell me about that for you.
Definitely. I love women who do things. That's who I end up writing about most of the time. I was thinking when I was in the shower this morning, actually, there are very few women with kind of in-depth physical descriptions of their face or body in my books. It comes if it's necessary, but in the most part, it's not beyond... Because A, I want readers to fill that stuff in for themselves.
Yeah.
But B, because it's not the thing I'm interested in.
Yeah.
The thing I'm interested in is, what are they thinking? What are they feeling? Are they capable? How do they occupy space in the world? Those are the questions that I'm interested in when I'm building a character. But it does come with a cost, which is, you know... Like the early stages of my career, when I stopped being a journalist and started being a fiction writer, I also moved to the country, which was a double whammy in that I realised when I went out there that people made assumptions on me based on how I looked and the fact that I had a child, which was basically, you are not interesting to me. And I wanted to say, hang on, I've just been, you know, I covered the death of Diana. I've been, you know, running around in a riot with bricks flying over my head. Nobody cared, because to them I was just this blonde woman living in the country with babies who liked horses. Therefore, they could put me in a box, which is, you know, you're probably married to someone in finance. I wasn't. You know, just that they make, we all make assumptions about sure. people. In fact, I had dinner with a mutual friend of ours recently, John Niven, who, when I was telling him the story of where and how I grew up, said, oh my God, I always assumed that you were posh.
I've told Niv before that you're not posh.
Yes, I know, but it's, but people look at me and I look a certain way and I have a certain life and they make massive assumptions. And to some extent, that's great. You know, underestimate me. I'd much rather you did that, because then I'm going to sneak around the edge and do what I want to do and nobody's going to pay any attention.
So you mentioned that you had a daughter during that time. So this is the most sort of uniquely mentalizing point in a woman's relationship with her appearance.
Yeah.
For good or bad.
Yeah.
It, you have children, your body changes, your function changes, the function of your boobs changes.
God. I mean, my body everything. Changed. I was 7.5 stone. When I had my first child, I was always slight. I was one of those revolting people who could eat 2 massive bowls of bolognese and it just wouldn't show the next day. All my 3 children were big babies. I think my last one was 9-11. Yeah, it was a shock coming out the other side. It was a shock because I didn't just wake up with my mother's body. I woke up with my grandmother's body. I was just like, what just happened to me?
Yeah.
And the weight didn't shift. And I'd been sick all the way through.
Oh,
all
God.
My pregnancies. So yeah. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything. I mean, I wasn't hyperemesis gravidarium level, but I was sick from the moment I woke up till when I went to sleep, or I was nauseous or throwing up. And so I just didn't pay any attention to my body or my face for years. I think the first 10 years of having children, I'm not sure I could have told you where my makeup bag lived.
Did you lose part of yourself? Because I say that not because I think anybody needs to wear makeup. I don't give a damn. But it's that moment, those 10 minutes with yourself in the mirror, right, are a moment with yourself. And that's the thing that's missing from being with your children very often, that you don't have that moment.
I just didn't have it. I just didn't look. I was too tired. I was living, you know, it's when you have 3 young children, it's like being in a war zone. I mean, I think war zones are easier, and I speak as someone who's been
in them. Yeah.
Because you are fragmented. There are 3 people wanting things from you all the time, like minute to minute. You're just crisis jumping for the whole day. And luckily, I had a very low maintenance husband who didn't mind the fact that he barely got any attention from me, because I was scraping my way through the day. And also, I think I didn't have much of a network at that point. I'd moved out to the country. I hadn't found my people in the way that you need to find your people.
You do.
And I think I just, I was the least important thing on my to-do list. I was just about functioning. But I haven't spoken about this before, but I am going to speak about it. The thing that really preoccupied me a lot was pain as well, because
I didn't know that about you.
I didn't know this, but my stomach muscles completely separated in my first pregnancy. Nobody picked up on it.
I think that happens a lot, right?
Yeah. And my former sister-in-law, who was a midwife, she noticed it. And I thought, oh, I'll knit them back together with hard work. So I was the idiot.
So things become unmeshed, don't they? Your stomach becomes unmeshed, and there's sort of 2 sides hanging independently inside.
Literally, yes. It's like, you know, you remember those sort of zip toys that you could put things in? I was basically a zip toy with the zip undone. And I tried to do sit-ups every morning, which is apparently the worst possible thing you can do. But being a grafter, I was like, well, I can will myself back into my old shape.
Yeah.
And so I would try all these things. But with every successive pregnancy, I was in more pain. And I learned to live with it, because in this country, you're told you've got 3 beautiful babies. You're just going to have to accept
it's
everything.
Just part
that comes
of being a woman.
It. It's just part of being a woman.
Yeah.
And I sucked that up, because there is a bit of me that isn't great at self-care and prioritizing myself. And I just suffered from endless back episodes. I mean,
so would you wake up in the morning and feel some discomfort before you'd even had a cup of tea?
Oh God, yeah. I mean,
all
you just live with it. You just live with it. And then I had the worst possible thing, which was I bought a horse when I was 31, and mucking out is like the worst thing you can do if you have problematic back issues.
You have to really throw your back into it, don't you?
Yeah, and it's heavy and you're doing the wrong angles. Yeah. And but the things needed doing. And funny enough, I'm in therapy now, and my therapist told me something that really stuck with me recently. And she said, you have a worryingly high tolerance for your own discomfort. And I don't know if that's coming from a kind of very Protestant work ethic-y family, but it's just
hard to relate to that. Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. So I just do stuff. I'm a plower on her. And I got to the point when my youngest, so it'd be about 2018, where the back episodes were so frequent. I mean, my ex-husband, bless him, he would at least 3 or 4 times a year, he would come into a room and I would just be on the floor going, I can't move. And I had tried everything. I'd done yoga. I had seen every local physiotherapist and osteopath everywhere. And I have a publisher, Louise Moore, who has basically been responsible for all the success that I've had in my career. And she is my go-to on all matters beauty, mm-hmm. body. Mm-hmm. She just knows all the best mm-hmm. people. And she recommended, she said, I think you should go and see this guy. And I went to see, I've forgotten his name.
David Floyd.
Thank you, David Floyd. We've had this conversation.
So I should say, I know this story. I was not going to ask Jojo about it because I didn't know she wanted to talk about it. I'm so glad you are talking about it, though. So you went to see David Floyd.
I went to see him, and I explained the situation, and he asked me to get down to my underwear mm-hmm. with a nurse in the room, mm-hmm. I hasten to add. He's a very decent
I've met him.
Human
He's
being.
A very nice man. He's like someone's nice dad, isn't he?
And he said, stand up and sit down in that chair. Stand up and sit down. And I did that. And it literally took him 30 seconds. And he said, your stomach muscles have separated from your sternum to your pubic bone, and there's
Bloody
nothing
hell.
Holding you up. No wonder you've got backache. And I said, but I can't feel anything. He said, yeah, but you can actually have kind of flesh, or I don't know what the technical bit was, but you can have things regrow. So it doesn't look like a hernia or anything. You couldn't see it from the outside. But he said, I can tell you just from how you stand, what happens to your stomach when you stand up and sit down, that there's nothing.
And what did happen to your stomach when you stood
so
up and
I
sit
actually,
down?
When I had the operation, I got him to take a picture.
Oh,
because
I love
the ex-journalist
like
in me.
Yeah, I love things
yeah,
like this.
And they draw a line, a black mark on both sides of the muscle that has separated. And it was, I mean,
could drive
about 3 inches apart. You could drive a bus through it. And it was big. It was from the top. It was exactly as he'd said, from the top to the bottom. And I had never had any surgery of any kind. I'd had my wisdom teeth removed mm-hmm. when I was about 14. And I was terrified. I'm a massive catastrophist. Like, and I had 3 kids. And I was just like, there's no way I can do that. But at the time, so this was, late 2018, I think, my mom was dying of cancer.
Yeah.
My marriage was breaking up. And there was a bit of me that just went, you know what? Fuck it.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this morning on the way in. And this is going to sound so tragic, but I'm just going to be really honest. I was so depressed at that point, not in a way that, would have affected him giving me surgery. My life was so dark at that point that I was actually looking forward to someone knocking me out for 3.5 hours.
Wow.
And that sounds so terrible to think back on now, mm-hmm. but that's where mm-hmm. my brain was at.
And to wake up and be thinking about something else.
Yeah.
To be thinking about your recovery.
And he was very straightforward. He said, this is the worst recovery of any operation
it's
that we do.
It's a major one, yeah.
But it has the highest satisfaction results. Mm-hmm. And I paid for it myself. And I was lucky enough to be able to pay for it. And I went in and I remember he said, you're going to have to stay in bed effectively on and off for the first 2 weeks. And I said, well, I can't do that. And he said, why? And I said, because if I stay in bed at that angle, my back's going to go.
And
he went, yeah, well, let's just see. And I remember coming to after the operation and probably off my tits on whatever drug it is they gave you, but thinking, oh my God, my back doesn't hurt.
Wow.
And it was like
immediate.
And even though I had to spend all that time in bed, which would normally have sent me into an absolute pain crisis, I just couldn't do it. It was the best investment in myself I have ever made. I could kiss that man again and again and again. But it also left me furious because I thought there are so many women like me who have kids and then are just told.
And are just left to kind of.
Yeah. Fend.
So your back was holding up your entire body, basically.
Yeah. And I remember
it had no assistance.
I had my third child at home And I remember all my family came round, you know, in dribs and drabs. And then, of course, the baby was angelic all day. And then everyone went to sleep. And I always used to say to my husband, you go to sleep because one of us has to.
Yeah.
And obviously it wasn't me. And I remember Lockie waking up at about 11 o'clock at night and trying to walk around the house to soothe this screaming newborn or crying newborn. And I couldn't stand up. And now I realize it's like there was literally... at that point, because I'd just given birth as well, there was nothing. And I remember walking around the house like a question mark because I couldn't.
Wow.
There was nothing to straighten up with. And one of the things I've done for myself since moving back to London, which we can talk about, but I started Reformer Pilates in May.
I love Pilates. It's the only thing I can do. I hate all exercise except Pilates.
And I now have such a strong core and it brings me joy every time I use it. I posted something a bit tragic to Instagram this last night because I'd just tried an advanced move with my brilliant Pilates teacher called The Swan, which involves so much core strength, and I'd done it. And I think back to all those years when I went through life with a constant mental calculation of what's going to cause me pain, what's the result of this activity going to be. And I don't want to paint myself out to be some kind of martyr, because you just adapt. You know, loads of people live with chronic pain, and it wasn't, you know, I could function perfectly well, but I can't pretend that it wasn't there. And it feels like such a privilege to live without that pain and the
you,
fear of
I mean,
that
you
pain.
Wouldn't have been able to build up that strength again in Pilates without the operation, would you?
No,
you wouldn't
and actually,
have been able
people,
to.
You know, when people sort of say that it's terribly self-indulgent or, you know, well, you could have done that with exercise. I just remember the picture that I've got on my phone.
Yeah.
And I go, yeah, you tell me how you're going to pull, because he actually reattached two layers of muscle, and it's
that were just swimming on their own somewhere else.
Just sort of, I don't know what was holding them together, bits of gossamer.
Yeah.
And I didn't even care what it looked like. I just wanted to be reattached. And what was also interesting, I lost 2 inches off my waist after that operation, because
everything was in the right place.
Everything
again
was in the right place. And I love that man, and I will always love that man for what he's done, because I think as I got older, that would have become more and more painful as well. And it would have stopped me doing a lot of the things that I do now.
Well, that solves a mystery, because I did some videos after my breast reduction. And I mentioned in the video that a good friend of mine had had abdomen surgery with a plastic surgeon. I've had so many messages speculating on who that is. And I've never said who it is, because it's not my news to tell, but it was Jojo Morris.
No, and I think I felt very ambivalent about talking about it for a long time, because there is, you know, this, it feels like, and maybe this is me and not the rest of the world, but it feels like an indulgence.
Right.
But
so then, I want to talk about that, because that is definitely a thing. That is definitely a thing. So after, she's now gone public as well, but after I had my breast reduction, Jess Phillips and I had this long conversation. She was saying, do you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it.
Oh, okay.
And so she did it after
a
me.
A breast reduction.
And, yes.
Yeah.
And she's now gone public with it, so I can talk about it. But we were in constant conversation throughout the whole thing. And what really struck me around that time, I think probably 50 women who follow me, some in the public eye, some absolutely not, and I were in correspondence about their various operations, which was lovely. Like, it was really lovely. But so many of them said, it's so nice to talk to you, because I don't feel I can tell my friends, because I don't want them to think I'm being vain, or I don't want them to think I'm being extravagant. Because, you know, breast reduction's £10,000, your surgery was probably 20 odd or whatever.
Yeah.
And you know, it's lots of money. I think women are made to feel, well, why are you spending all that money? You should be spending on something important.
Oh,
as though their comfort is not important.
But this is exactly it.
Or even, and frankly, their appearance. I don't care if somebody wants to spend it on a facelift. It's none of my business.
No,
you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, let's just try not to judge each other all the time. It's just so depressing. But I think so much of what I feel about my own well-being and my sense of confidence in myself comes from functionality, strength, being able to do the things that I need to do. And, you know, I think maybe I was more wobbly about it a few years ago. And now, you know, I'm 54. I can't be bothered to lie to people about stuff, even by omission. Also, I wish more women could have this, because it has been life-changing. And I've recommended him to other women with similar back issues.
He's lovely. I saw him.
And it's completely changed their lives.
Yeah.
And if we lived in France, this would have been picked up, you know, straight after the birth. They come around, they check you in all sorts of ways and recommend things. Women's sense of, you know, well-being is considered more important than it is here. Here, you're just meant to be grateful for your baby, and that's it. And we're all grateful for our baby. I mean, who the hell isn't?
There's another tier of judgment that I really experienced after I got my boobs done, because you and I were talking about my boobs at the time, weren't we? All of this was happening at similar times. There's this other veil of judgment where people just want to check that you were actually in pain. Because if you were in pain, it's fine.
Yeah.
And if you just wanted nicer boobs or smaller boobs or a flatter stomach or whatever, then it's less fine.
Yeah.
It's this idea that women have to show that it was a kind of life and death decision.
Shall I get the receipts from my chiropractor? Okay, I'll do that.
So when you were fixed on the inside, did your feelings about the outside change?
Yeah. I mean, this is going to sound really stupid and naive, but when he told me that my stomach muscles had separated from top to bottom, there was a bit of me, and maybe this is me just being too busy to check things properly, that assumed I would have a line going, you know, I assumed he would have to pull them with a kind of vertical cut. And of course he didn't. He did
it's
in a bikini line. And so you can't even see it. And it is an extraordinary work of art as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So yes, I feel great. And it's, you know, I do reformer Pilates twice a week. I'm also riding horses four times a week. And at 54, I would say I look better without my clothes on than I have done in 20 years. And it's partly because I can do exercises that I could not have done before because the risk of putting my back out was going to be too great. But it's also because I just feel great in myself, which makes you want to do more. I'm not afraid to, you know, exercise in a bra top. I'm not, I just feel very confident physically in myself at the moment.
You mentioned the other day, which is why how I've ended up dragging you here. You mentioned that when you were growing up, it was on my Facebook wall, wasn't it? We were talking about Madonna. I had obviously just been seeing Madonna for the third time in a week. I'm sorry. I'm just like a lunatic. Anyway, so we were talking about Madonna. And what did you say about Madonna that pricked up my ears?
I said that when I was, I mean, it must have, what was I? Must have been about 16 or 17 the first time I saw her in concert. And she, I forget which tour it was. It might have been the Erotica tour. And she came down from the ceiling.
Yes, that was the girly show.
It was the girly show. Yeah. That was it.
But it was the Erotica album tour. I was
and
there.
She came down on this rope and she was in this little corset, but she had this physicality, this strength. You could see every muscle. And I know lots of people find that unattractive. I think it's beautiful. And I just saw this small woman, over-identifying here, with this amazing strength and total command of everything. And I thought, that's beautiful to me. That is what is beautiful to me. And I think, I only realized it when I made that comment to you, but I think that has been my beauty force my whole life, which is, I love muscles that are a little bit defined. I love women who look strong. I love women who can do stuff. You know, every exercise I've ever done, I loved boxing, I loved running, I loved riding, I loved things that are physically challenging. I'm no good at yoga because it requires too much internal focus. I can't sit.
It's just too spiritual for me, Jojo.
It just is.
I'm just not that person.
No, and what I like about reformer Pilates is you are in your head, but it's very much about making minute adjustments to what you're doing with your body in order to get stuff right.
Right.
And one of the benefits of exercising in the way that I did, because even when I was, when my back was going, I had a personal trainer for about 8 years in my, when I lived in the country, and she was a brilliant woman. She'll forgive me, Becky will forgive me for saying, I never once looked forward to a session. I didn't love like high intensity cardio. I did love boxing, and I loved anything that involved kind of impact or doing, but I had my bones measured for, is it osteoporosis recently, and I have the bones of a 30-year-old.
Wow.
And I think it's because of all this stuff I've done throughout my life to do with strength. So thank you, Madonna, for my hopefully avoiding osteoporosis.
I do think for lots of small women in particular, yeah. they will pick her out as somebody who was really influential. I saw her recently, as I say, and on the third time I went to see her in a week, I was in Antwerp and I was right down the front, and she's in her mid-60s now, and she had her back to me at one point doing a routine. She had a bare back, and we all gasped because I could see what seemed like 1,000 different muscles in her back all moving in this sort of kind of almost choreographed way. Every single muscle rippled. And I was thinking, oh my God, to be in your mid-60s.
And to be able to do that.
To be able to do that was absolutely extraordinary. So your apathy or kind of pleasant naivety around how you looked and being consequently disinterested in that, when did that switch? Because I have lots of girlfriends and I would put them into two categories. My girlfriends who love clothes and love stuff, and my girlfriends who are not that interested. So Catelyn would be in that one. I would definitely put you in the first group. So you like clothes and you like to look a certain way. You find it fun.
But it's come to me late.
It has.
It's come
so
to
when
me
did
so
that
late.
Happen?
I'd say when I got money.
Right.
I didn't have...
Not enough people say that.
No, I'm going to be honest.
I'm glad you've said that.
All my money, you know, in the early years of my career went into my family. It was just, I'm a catastrophist. We've spoken about this.
Yeah.
So I was always planning ahead. I was like, I need to pay the mortgage down as much as possible. I need to make sure we've got enough money to fix the roof. I am the worrier about finances. And then after me, before you became successful, it took me about a year or two to really digest that this wasn't a blip, that somehow I was going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you've grown up, you know, I was self-supporting from 17 like you. So I think that leaves a certain mental awareness all the time of, I have to look after myself because who knows what's going to happen tomorrow.
And then you have kids and you're I have to look after all of us or we're
screwed.
Exactly.
And that is my big psychological weakness. I am the fixer of everybody, and that's not always a good thing because you don't allow them to fix themselves anyway, blah blah blah, blah.
Nodding heavily.
But I would say I remember the first time I became really aware of my appearance again was in my 40s, and when I was having to promote the film of Me Before You, because I can tell you there's nothing like being on a promotional tour with two very beautiful young movie stars.
Right.
Emilia Clarke and Sam Claflin.
So I interviewed Emilia Clarke recently at an event. And I mean, she's so tiny and cute.
So tiny and fit and beautiful.
Yeah.
And she's a real worker as well. But I was like their nan. And well, I was 20 years older than the pair of them. And you're traveling with makeup artists all the time, which is great because suddenly you're seeing this much better version of yourself projected. And also I was learning things, you know, I was learning about, you know, we traveled with Amelia and a nutritionist at one point, and I cut out sugar from my diet, and that was kind of amazing. I had 2 weeks where I just ate what she ate basically. And that was, you suddenly go, oh, there's a reason these people look like they do. But I suppose then I just started buying better clothes. I had my hair cut more often. Before I would just literally go months between haircuts because I lived in the middle of nowhere. I had three kids. Nobody cared. It was me and a scrunchie.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're visible. That's the difference. Suddenly I was visible.
That's a really important point, right? So most writers can sit in their pajamas and they can.
And we do.
And we do. And you thrash out the book or you squeak out the book or whatever it is, but you are not visible and you exist through your characters or your interview subjects or your opinions or whatever. And you're just not on show. When you sell a large, huge number of books and you get into the realms of adaptations and so on, or in my very different case where you're hosting lots of events and that kind of stuff, it switches because it's not about what you write down just anymore. It's about how you look. That happened to you with one book, really, and then never stopped. It wasn't a slow burn. One book went nuclear and then that was you in front of the camera. Tell me about that process.
At first, it was kind of fun. I didn't. I mean, I had been doing writers' talks and everything for 10 years before I got successful. So I was used to a degree of visibility.
So like literary festivals, that
kind
of thing.
Yeah, but suddenly when the film came out and I was, you know, flying to LA, to New York, to Toronto, to, you know, you're doing these ridiculous junket days where you're on 40 different cameras a day and you're having to think about how you come across. And it makes you very hyper aware of yourself in a way that I'd never had to be. And I think the good thing was it was just before the internet turned really toxic. Mm-hmm. So I think I escaped a lot of the perhaps the more trolley kind of comments. Mm-hmm. And also the basic truth is people were wanting to look at Amelia. They, you know, I was the words, she was the face. Mm-hmm. And I think I was old enough and wise enough to kind of understand that and accept it. So it's not like I was trying to compete with her in looks. The thing that I find harder is not so much the visibility of my face, because actually I think I'm holding up okay.
Yes, certainly.
Most people think I'm younger than I am. I'm quite comfortable in my skin. Mm-hmm. It's just general visibility.
Yeah.
I am, you know, I moved to London recently and I found out too late that certain neighbours kind of knew who I was, mm-hmm. and had approached me because of who I was. And mm-hmm. there's still this naive part of me that thinks that I'm invisible. And that makes me very uneasy. I have the same best friend I've had since I was 16. Most of my friends I've known for decades. I think I've become increasingly less sociable.
Yeah.
Like lots of people post-pandemic. Yeah. I don't want to be visible. I'm not comfortable having my pitch taken. I've never been told how to do it. I have, you know, it's like my daughter, she's grown up in an age where they know how to present themselves on Instagram. And she'll, you know, I'll take 15 pictures of them and she'll go, nope, 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 yeah. nope, maybe, you know. And whereas I'll just go, you know, this is me doing a kind of goofy face and a thumbs up, because that's how we grew up. I suppose it's not even being judged on my appearance, because that I don't care so much about. I'm comfortable with who I am. It's just a kind of all round visibility. If I could kind of walk around in a black suit with a hat on, I'd be happy. Yeah. Does that sound terribly weird?
No, not at all. The funny thing I always think about getting older is by the time, in the very, very conventional marketing sense, you lose your looks. And I, you know, I say that in inverted commas because I certainly don't believe that. But in the way that we're told we have to look, when one starts to lose those specific types of looks, the handiness is that you're usually at a place in your life where you've processed enough that it matters a lot less.
Yes.
And you're taking care of your appearance in a different way for different reasons.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do a lot of self-care now, but I was thinking about it.
So what does that look like?
So I was thinking about it again on the mm-hmm. way in, because I've listened to so many of your podcasts and the way people talk about self-care. And I realized so much of mine is less about makeup mm-hmm. than it is about my mind and my body.
Uh-huh.
So I ride 4 times a week. I've taken up classical dressage in the last few months.
Amazing.
Which is a challenge. I tell you what it was. I got asked a really interesting question a few months ago, which I think may resonate with a lot of women. And, well, it was my shrink, actually. And she said, what do you do for you?
Yes.
And I said, well, I love walking my dogs on the heath in the morning. She went, no, that's not.
That's for the dog.
That's for the dogs. I said, okay, well, I like going to Pilates. And she went, nope, that's about staving off decrepitude and functionality. I said, well, I like a long bath in the evening. She went, nope, that's about just restoring something to yourself after a long day. What do you like doing for you?
What turns you on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I couldn't think of what I did for me. And
interesting.
I've had a horse since I was 30, or not the same horse, you know, they come and die. And mm-hmm. But I have a really lovely horse at the moment who is quite capable. And so I set myself a challenge, which is I've always been a non-competitive rider. The last competition I did, I think I was about 16. And I started learning, taking dressage lessons, and it's basically meant unlearning everything that I've learned over 40 years.
Because it's all dainty hooves, isn't it? It's all dancing and
footwork. Yeah, but it's also about really tiny shifts in your own movements and changes of
weight. To let the horse know what you want.
Yeah, it's about communication. And I've had to completely change the way that I communicate. And it was like unlearning the way that you drive initially.
Wow.
Nothing's made me feel more stupid. I cried in my first lesson.
Did you?
I felt so stupid. And something happened about 4 months in. And then I went to my first competition and I won, which I think blew my instructor's mind as much as it blew mine. And I then qualified for a championship and I came second in the championship.
Wow.
And I still have such a long way to go. I mean, I'm base level. But what it does is, it's a body workout in a lovely way because it's about tiny movements. It's not about throwing yourself out.
So you're tensing different parts of your body
or trying to really
to be totally still.
You're just giving very minute instructions and hoping that you're communicating in a way that the horse can hear them, and it's about harmony. But what it really does is take you out of your head, which is key for me. I can't think about anything else when I'm doing it. So I've done that, and yeah, that's probably the thing that I do for me. I'm really good about skincare. Like, I don't wear a lot of makeup. I've got makeup on today because I was seeing you, but I have a absolutely rock solid.
What do you do?
So every evening I use either an Elemis Trienzyme cleanser or Evelom, depending on how my skin feels.
So you like a balm?
I like a balm.
Me too.
But I do want water. I'm not one
Same.
Of these wipes people. I'll use the wipes to take off my eye makeup. And then I use Sunday Riley Good Genes Serum, which mm-hmm. has been a game changer for me because I didn't have very good skin for years. And maybe with hindsight, it was probably to do with horse dust and pollution and all the rest of it. But I could never get it clean enough. And I use a tiny bit of that 5 times a week before I go to bed. Augustinus Bader mm-hmm. Moisturizer. I use the rich cream at night and the
product.
Light cream in the day. And I've recently started moisturising a lot more than I used to because mm-hmm. I think I have
We
aging.
Just do get drier.
Yeah. I use, what's it called, Revita Brow.
Mm-hmm.
I paint that on about 4 times a week and that is extraordinary stuff.
It works.
It's basically restored my eyebrows.
It works. Lash and brow serums really work.
Yeah.
You just have to do them.
And it takes 3 months before you see a difference.
It takes 3 months and the minute you stop, you will revert. Things
yeah.
will shed. And that's what people don't understand. You just have to use them and keep on using
But it's
them.
Worth it
yeah.
because
yeah.
I think I've got really good brows mm-hmm. now. And what I've learned about getting older is that your brows are really crucial
yes.
to framing your face.
Yes.
It makes such a huge difference. So yeah, I don't use eye cream and I don't use neck cream. I just use the things that I've got. But I will never go to bed with anything on my face. I don't think I could sleep.
In makeup?
Yeah. It would actually disturb me.
Even if pissed?
Nope. Never. I am.
I mean, respect. I think I probably do it about twice a year. I think about twice a year. I've actually done it deliberately on occasions when I've been testing something that claims to be unbudgeable.
Okay.
I've done it on purpose, but you do just feel nasty the next day.
No.
You feel nasty.
No. And also I think it helps that I don't wear a lot of makeup. I mean, I wear Dermalogica 50 SPF tinted skin primer.
Mm-hmm.
A makeup artist in New York showed me that. And, you know, you just put a tiny bit on and it just evens out my skin
yeah.
tone enough
and
to
protected.
Make me feel like I can get on with life. I get my teeth whitened every 3 years, 2 to 3 years. I gave up drinking in January,
mm-hmm.
Which has made a massive difference, not just to my skin, but to my sleep. And what I discovered about sleep as someone who was a chronic insomniac for probably 2 decades, I now sleep an average of 6 to 7 hours a night. And that might not sound a lot to some of your listeners, but it was not unusual for me to function on 3 to 4.
So I've known you a long time and
yeah.
I would never, ever have said she drinks much.
No,
so,
no.
So I'm not a heavy drinker. I don't think of you ever as a heavy drinker.
No.
So you obviously weren't pushed into it by need to give up drink. So why do you think you stopped?
Well, I'd found I'd got to a point where red wine was my drink of choice. I love a cocktail, but red wine was the thing that I would have maybe two glasses a night, four nights a week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't really drink at home.
And it was just habit. I think it began when the children
lockdown
were small.
Lockdown as well was
a
huge
lockdown
thing.
Oh, it was definitely terrible.
I definitely drank a lot more in lockdown than usual.
Yeah. But I found that I processed red wine a lot less well than I used to. And I'm sure that's, I mean, I haven't gone through menopause yet, but bloody hell, I wish it would hurry up.
Yeah.
But it definitely, there has been a way that I process alcohol that has gone. And so the only red wine I could really drink was Pinot Noir, really light red. But even that, I would wake up at least once a night, just
feeling
disrupted.
What?
Oh, I don't know, just, you know, spinny head, 4 a.m. thoughts. What was it called? The lizard brain kicking in.
Kind of groggy.
You, everything is dark.
Yeah.
And the really base level thing I discovered about if you sleep enough, you don't actually need the expensive skincare because sleep fixes everything. If you see me, like a few times I've actually had 8 hours sleep, which I can't even tell you how much of a queen I feel after 8 hours. It feels like Christmas every day. But my skin just looks amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think of all the years
you can see it on your face that you're sleeping.
Yeah. Of course, I woke up with two little spots this morning because I was seeing you. But
well, I burnt my face yesterday by blowing out a candle. I've got a big red spot on my face because I blew out a candle and the hot wax blew out into my face. I know. I hope it doesn't scar.
Oh, I hope you're wearing glasses. So I didn't.
Yeah, I was. So I didn't get any in my eye because I wear glasses. Yeah.
Yeah. So sleep is a biggie. And I did. I just thought I'd do dry January because I'd never done it. I mean, as you say, I'm not a heavy drinker, never have been. I can go wild periodically, but it had become less and less attractive to me, mostly because of the kind of awful waking up the next day going, what did I say to who? And also
replaying the tapes.
Yeah. And especially because my life has changed a bit and suddenly you're in a room with kind of more impressive people rather than your old mates. And then you're thinking, did I fangirl horribly over that person or did I I don't want to have those thoughts. So I did dry January, felt pretty good, thought okay, well let's see how this goes. And I'm not going to say I've had nothing this year. I've had periodic cocktails or the odd glass of wine. I've got an NHS app that I can monitor, which sort of pleases me because I can keep track of what I've done, and I just don't miss it. I found a really good zero alcohol beer that I have once a night. I have one of those every evening with some chocolate buns. I'm so rock and roll. But it's heaven to me and I sleep better. And to me, sleep is everything because it means I want to exercise. I want to go out and do stuff. I go out first thing in the morning with my dogs on the heath. I do an hour and a half, 2.5-3 miles with them. And that's how I stay mentally well. And I think in my 50s, my key priority is just staying physically and mentally and emotionally level, really.
Funny. Trini said the same thing when Trini was on. She was saying that, you know, her priority above all else is to stay well for a long time.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to see the amazing people that she's going to see, but I am functionally really good at the moment. And like many people, I had a really terrible pandemic, you know.
Yours was quite bad, Jojo. I would say, the people I know and love, I would say your lockdown was not great. Your pandemic was not great.
No, my mum was dying of blood cancer. My marriage was breaking up. There were various, my beloved big dog was dying as well. She was a rescued Great Pyrenean who was absolutely enormous. It was my friendly polar bear. And we had a pandemic.
Yeah.
And I had a kind of, I won't say a nervous breakdown because that overplays it, but I certainly fell apart through overwork. I did. And that taught me a lot of lessons. And
is work where you go to when you're trying not to think about other stuff?
But I didn't know that.
Because that will bite you on the ass.
It did. It bit me hard. And I used to travel all the time. I was always touring the States. I was always going backwards and forwards for film stuff in LA. And it's lovely and it's great. And you know, I'm really lucky to have this rich career. But what I was also doing, I realized, was evading
displacement activity.
Yeah, it was all displacement. And then suddenly lockdown made us sit with our feelings.
Right.
And it was awful and it was really useful because I had nowhere to go and I just had to do it and I had to sit with it and I had to work on my own part in it because none of us are free from guilt or blame or whatever. And I would say I've learned more about how to live in this big old world of ours in the last 4 years than I did in the last 40. You know, and also, you know, getting divorced and having to navigate new relationships. You know, when you've been married a long time, and I was married 22 years, you get into certain patterns that work for both of you and you don't have to examine any of it because you just find your groove in which you can operate. And suddenly that groove is gone and you have to show up in front of different people. And, you know, also it's terrifying going out into the world at 50 as a single woman because...
I mean, tell me about that, because this is the experience of lots of girls I know, girls, women, where they're on round two, because we're at that age. People are on round two. I'm on my second and I think last husband. you're divorced. You know, we're at that age where people are on round two and restarting. And people, you know, since people were last dating, the internet exists. And or in the case of gay friends, gay bars don't really exist in the way they used to. So you don't know who's gay anymore because everything's so tolerant. And, you know, so you can go into a bar and it's mixed automatically. Mm. So what has been your experience of getting back out there?
Well, I didn't because I remember I'd been on my own about a year and I thought maybe I just have to do a dating app. And and also, I'd been hit on by all sorts of inappropriate people.
Right.
Like, that was kind of a surprise. And I suppose that's why, as well, I didn't feel unattractive and I didn't feel invisible. But the people who were hitting on me shouldn't have been hitting on me. Or, you know, it was just, there were a couple of, I don't want to sort of talk about them and identify them, but I had a couple of really inappropriate and that just leaves you thinking, oh, I don't think I like it out here. This is not my thing. And then after about a year, I felt really lonely. And I thought, I'm going to download a dating app. And I had a full-blown panic attack.
I mean, I
just
know
looked
what to
at
do.
These men. And I thought, is this my future? And I remember being on the phone to my best friend going, oh, my God. God, and her just going, delete the app, just take it off your phone, because she could hear that I was about to.
Yeah.
Because that, again, I'd never had panic attacks till I was in my late 40s. And that was, you know, part of the great joy of that little period of my life. And she could hear it coming. And I was like, I can't do this. And I deleted it immediately.
The toxic thing about those apps is all the women I know who've been on them have been on them for a very short amount of time, where they've either gone, this is like having another job. It's such a commitment to do them. But also because the toxicity of those apps is that everything is appearance. Everything. You just look at people's pictures and decide if you want to go on a date with them. And that's not the case in real life, is it? You talk to someone, they're funny, or they say an interesting thing, and you become interested in them. But nobody's got time for that anymore. So people just look at a picture.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't.
No.
And also, I think it's a bit weird as well. I mean, I'm not like famous, but I'm not quite.
You're in a funny middle
famous.
Point.
I'm in a weird. And I had this, I think this is the invisibility thing again. I had this terror of ending up as an anecdote. Like I just didn't want to become someone's dinner party story, either as a bad date or a sexual experience or something. And it gave me massive sympathy for people who are properly famous, because like, how the hell do you navigate that if you are like visibly famous? It's only my name that people know. They don't necessarily know my face, which is a blessing in some ways, but so actually the first person I went out with was somebody I'd known 30 years ago who I met at a party, you know, not long after that whole dating app experience. And that was lovely because it was somebody who had known me when I was 20 and who I could trust because I knew the kind of person that they were.
That's so interesting, though, because you'd known each other since you were 20 and hadn't really seen each other in a very long time. So you both looked completely different.
Oh, my God, so different.
Complete, of course. And what did you think about that? Did that cross your mind? Like, I'm literally 30 years older.
No, because the weird thing was we immediately reverted to being 20.
Right.
We both have quite a childish sense of humour. And oh, you know, and also neither of us wanted a relationship. So it just felt like two people goofing around again.
Yeah.
Until it wasn't.
Yeah.
And actually, yeah, it was, I think, yeah, I'd been seeing him on and off in a kind of, in quite a boundary. We were both like, this is very much not a thing. And then my mum died and he took care of me in a way that I felt like I had never been taken care of before. Not
gave
like,
you
not
a soft place to fall.
That's such a lovely way of putting it, but just cooked for me and took me to his family house and just, it was about being cared for. And I think at this age, to be cared for as a woman feels
it's like a
radical thing. And I'm very good at caring for other people. I'm really good at caring for other people. I'm not so good at caring for myself.
Were you immediately able to accept it, though? Because it took me quite a long time to be able to accept it.
I think that's a work in progress.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm getting better at it, definitely, because what are you going to do? I mean, it's so easy to build walls at this age. Sorry, this has become a psychotherapeutic
podcast. Wow, that's the way we like it.
It's really easy to build walls at this age because everything is scary and you know the emotional cost of everything. And, you know, my husband and I were happy for a long time until we weren't. And I'm very proud that it was the most amicable of splits. So amicable.
You were both
very elegant about it. Yeah, and so amicable that the lawyer wrote me a letter afterwards congratulating me on how nice we'd
been to
each other.
A divorce well done.
I'm very proud of that letter.
Yeah.
But anybody who's been through a divorce knows it is brutal.
It's hell,
It's just awful. It's no matter how gentle you are with each other, it's awful. So you're really conscious at this age that any romantic entanglement has the potential to bring great pain.
Yes.
And also, in your 50s, you're kind of conscious that it could be not divorce or splitting up that causes the pain. It could be some terrible illness or death.
Right.
So I think the fun thing is I'm much better at living in the moment. I don't catastrophize anymore. I think the last few years of kind of Sturm und Drang is that the right thing? Have taught me you just have to be in it, you know, just enjoy each day. I'm very good at gratitude. I'm very good at feeling pleasure in small things. I feel very proud of my kids, which is a huge thing. And in fact, I wanted to say to you, I mean, I totally agree with you about magazines. I think they get a raw deal. But one of the things I'm really proud of with my daughter is her body image and her attitude to herself. And one of the things I did when she hit 12 was I removed all gossip mags. You know, I used to love all that kind of stuff when I was in my 30s. I took all those out of the house. So, I mean, we might have the odd Vogue or something, but nothing that criticized women's appearances.
Right.
And the other thing I did was I never focused on how she looked. I focused on how she felt.
Yes.
So do you feel strong? Are you doing this?
Yes.
Are you doing that? And she has the best kind of, not in an arrogant way, but she's just totally aware of what she needs to feel good in herself. She exercises a lot. She looks great. She's kind of confident in a really lovely way. And I feel like...
That's huge, isn't it?
It really is.
It's huge.
And she doesn't have any body dysmorphia or eating disorders or anything. I think it's really important to teach girls to look outwards and not inwards. Mm-hmm. And I think in an Instagram age where everybody's always being encouraged to project a certain thing...
And hear feedback on how they look
constantly. And judge themselves
based on... I just didn't have that in my young life. It's so different for girls now.
Oh, my God, terrifying. So the key thing I want to say to young women is look outwards.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see?
Mm-hmm.
What interests you? What do you care about? What do you need? Not the judgment of strangers, that's for sure.
So you mentioned you're 54. You also mentioned that you are by nature a fixer.
Yeah.
I am exactly the same. And we have our own therapeutic journey on this because it's both good and bad.
Yes.
It's useful and a hindrance. So if you are by nature a fixer, talk to me about tweaks. And did you go on a journey with the idea of injections?
Did I go on a journey? I had, oh my God, my first Botox injection, I would say, what was I? Maybe 51? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I can't even remember because it's not been a regular part of my life. And I had it mostly because, like most writers, I spend my whole day frowning at a screen.
Yes, yes.
And I'd ended up with this groove.
Uh-huh.
And I used to drive holding this groove
to try and flatten it out.
Flatten it out because I could feel it.
So between your eyes. That's the classic first place people get Botox.
So, yes, I had that done and that was revelatory. And I haven't been incredibly regular about getting you can probably tell I haven't got any at the moment because everything is incredible. I have a very hypermobile face. I wish it was more elegant and composed, but I tend to kind of pull faces as I speak. So I probably, I probably need to do it again. But I feel rested when I have that brow thing furrowed out. I feel less Cro-Magnon man. I feel less caveman, you know, because I've got my father's face in a lot of ways. I'm quite, if I showed you a picture of him and I went like that, you would see my dad. Sorry, that's really bad for a podcast, but I've basically just pulled a kind of Stan Laurel face. I tried fillers, which was when I got divorced or in the run up to my divorce, I lost a lot of weight very dramatically, like a lot of
standard
women do.
You and either gain loads or you lose loads. It's the same thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I can see pictures of myself now and I look gaunt. I mean, and what I didn't realise, you know, it's that Catherine Deneuve face, it's face or ass beyond a certain point. And I lost both, basically. And I had these nasolabial folds.
Yes.
Like I had these extra grooves in my face that I'd never seen before. And so when I went to get the Botox, I said to this woman, what can I do about this? I don't want a facelift, but is there do I just need to put on more weight? Or and she said, if you put a tiny dot of filler in your cheekbones, it will actually lift up a millimeter.
It'll give them some scaffolding.
And it worked. And I'm not sure I would do it repeatedly because I've seen too many people who've had a lot of filler badly, and there's that sort of slightly weird apple
puffiness
cheek thing that goes on. And I don't feel like I need it at the moment either, so I feel like I'm comfortable with where my face is.
And you didn't feel weird about any of it?
I probably wouldn't have told anybody at the time, but nobody noticed. Everyone just said, oh, you look better.
Yes, this is the thing. I think when I hear people say, oh, Botox looks so weird, and it's like, well, by definition, you're talking about bad Botox.
Yeah, and actually, when I have, I had Botox and I had the filler injection. That would have been 2019 or something. And I paid for the best ones that I could afford. I had a cleaner at the time who said to me, oh, I've trained in Botox. Do you want me to do you?
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, I've just watched you clean my loo. You are literally the
last. It's so unregulated.
It was a nice offer, but
it's so unregulated, isn't it?
So I went, I can't even remember where I went. It was somebody who, my friend who's a makeup artist, Fiona Johnston King, she'd recommended. And that was it. It was a German woman in Harley Street. I forget what her name is. But I felt very unnerved. But I think something happened to me around that time because my life was just a bin fire. There was a bit of me that was just going, oh, yeah, fuck it.
Yes.
Let's just do it. Who cares?
Yeah.
So I come out looking like Jocelyn Wildenstein. Who cares? And luckily it did work. It just took away that slightly gaunt thing. And then I think she said it would take about 18 months to disappear, and it did. And by that stage, I'd put back on kind of half a stone to a stone.
So you didn't feel the need?
No. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you, Sally. I would love to do something about my neck. I'm fully Nora Ephron in the feeling bad about my neck stakes. Mm-hmm. But as I said to a friend this morning, the beauty of being 5'2½, half is very important, is that most people look down on me. So they're not going to see
the
underside of my neck.
and teeth. I know you feel strongly that teeth are the thing that age.
Yeah, I think
the most.
I go to a very good guy in Soho who India Knight recommended. She's another one of the people who I listen to in terms of recommendations, because she said this guy does it in a way that doesn't damage your teeth. And so I'm very kind of wary on any treatments. Like, what's the possible downside to this? How am I going to feel if this goes wrong? And with teeth, you know, you don't want to give yourself added sensitivity. And his name's Wyman Chan.
Yes, I've been to him.
Oh, you've been
to him. He's on Shaftesbury Avenue.
Yeah. And so I get that done every couple of years. And I think I got Invisalign 3 or 4 years ago, when your jaw starts to shrink in your late 40s, early 50s.
I'm against it. I don't like it. So I have...
Oh, Invisalign jaw shrinking?
My jaw shrinking, yeah. I'm against it generally.
No, I think it's entirely unacceptable. but my mother's teeth, you know, did shift, and I've watched it happen to people. And it's been interesting to me how many of my girlfriends in their 50s have recently done exactly the same thing. And it wasn't a lot of fun. You know, my first relationship after my divorce, my only relationship after my divorce, and I was having to remove my retainers.
Luckily you knew as a teenager.
Yeah, exactly, so it was fine.
Yeah, I'm sitting here in fixed braces now.
Yeah,
because
I had elastics
move.
As well, because my jaws had moved so dramatically. But I think reasonably white, not Hollywood white, but reasonably white, straight teeth.
Yes.
Good smile.
Yeah.
And good energy.
Yeah.
And decent clothes, those will carry you just as far as any tweakments. And don't quote me on this in 5 years when I'm coming back to you begging for a facelift and asking you if you know anybody good. But at the moment, in just on the right side of 55, I feel like I'm doing okay.
You sound like you like being the age you are.
I think I do. And I think it's as much to do with the mental work and emotional work that you put in as any. I think, you know, I've watched my daughter's generation fill their faces with lip plumpers and fillers and Botox. And I think, boob jobs. And I'm like, you're 25.
Yeah.
What do you know of yourself at this age? And I don't want to criticize them because clearly they feel a need. But I find it really hard to accept that people can't feel how beautiful they are at that age. Because, you know, if I'd known how gorgeous I was, you know, my body was at 18, I would have spent a decade in a bikini and nothing else.
Well, as Nora Ephron said, you know, as soon as you turn 16, do me a favour, put on a bikini and don't take it off till you're 35.
Oh, she's already got their bikini. Of course she has.
But it's true, right? You have no, when you're at your most stunning, you have no idea.
No,
you're so
busy
harsh on yourself.
Looking at non-existent pieces of cellulite that you will look at yourself in 20 years and go, what was I complaining about?
Yeah.
And I think I feel really happy physically with where I am at the moment. And I think I could spend, I think it's about energy at this age. You know, I met the artist at Marina Abramovic last week, and she's 77. And I think there's been a bit of work, but that's not the key thing about her. The key thing about her was wisdom and energy. She was the most charismatic person I'd ever met. Like, I couldn't take my eyes from her. Mm-hmm. And it's because, yes, she's 77, but she had a life force around her that was palpable. And I feel like at this age, what affects me about people is, what energy are they giving out? You could be the most beautiful person in the world.
How are you making people around you feel?
Am I interested in you? Do I want to learn things from you? I think the best part of being a journalist in your formative years is endless curiosity. And I feel like this is the decade of learning. And some of it's going to sound a bit self-indulgent, especially to our parents' generation. But for me, it's about, how do I navigate this world in the best way possible in the time that I have left? How do I look after myself? How do I look after other people? How do I show up? How do I make a positive impact on myself and everything else? And I feel like the thing that is energizing me at the moment is learning these little lessons, whether it's listening to someone talk about their art or listening to the best place to get Botox or finding kind of that I can make my body do things that I didn't think it could do. All these things are little lessons. And I think that's what keeps me animated. And I think animated and energized is beautiful. That's the energy I want to take into my later years, because that's what I find compelling. And I hope that people around me will find it compelling.
Well, Jojo Moyes, thank you for showing up and having, I'm sure, what will be a positive impact on others. I've loved talking to you, and now we get to go to lunch and talk some more. Thank you so much for coming on, and thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review and any comments that you have, and go back into the back catalogue. So many brilliant guests this series. I just feel like we've had great conversations, and hopefully those conversations will continue online. Let me know your thoughts. In the meantime, thank you, Jojo.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
I feel like I should have talked more about favourite lipsticks, but there you
go. No, it's fine. It's fine. If you tell me after, we'll put it in the show notes. Okay. Lots of love to you all. Bye-bye.
Insanity Group.